Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is the 12th of April, 12 minutes actually, past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us. It is a beautiful weekend for the most part, and a little rain today, so we'll, that seems about right. I'd rather it that than the other way, I think. Good morning, everyone. Let me introduce our panel to you, and then I'll remind you how you can become a part of the program. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Joe? I'm fine. It's beginning. The week is beginning.
Absolutely.
And Friday, it will end.
That's right. Today was the beginning. Friday will be the end. And then we'll stir, mix, enjoy, and repeat, right?
Yes. And then the following Monday.
Yeah, so you'll get right back and start it all over again. Sarah Rogerson is with us, Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm doing well.
Excellent. Very nice to hear your voice. We go to Sienna Freeman Tolbert and welcome her to the program, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany Law Firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning, Sienna.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Always a great thrill to have you on the program. And Libby Post is with us, a political consultant and dear friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm just fine.
Excellent. Good to hear. A reminder that if you'd like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will welcome your letters. We can't get to all of them, obviously, but we can try to get to as many as we can. Keep them short, keep them to the point, and we would love to hear from you. So this is sort of a late addition to the lineup this morning, and it was a story that broke in Minnesota last night, and it is a troubling story and one that we can just ponder for a moment and then move on to our other stories that we were planning for this morning. But Minnesota officer shoots black driver and protesters clash with police. So that is another very disturbing story that's coming out of a place that is 10 miles away from where the Derek Chauvin case will continue. I believe it's third week today. A young man pulled over for a traffic violation, died after being shot near Minneapolis, where Derek Chauvin is on trial over the killing and the death of George Floyd. A 20-year-old black man died. It was during a traffic stop on Sunday, sending hundreds of people into the streets where they clashed with police officers well into the early hours of this morning. The protest in Brooklyn Center came hours before the 11th day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who's been charged with the murdering of George Floyd, and that is set to begin in a courtroom less than 10 miles away. Outside of the Brooklyn Center Police Department on Sunday, smoke billowed into the air as a line of police officers fired rubber bullets and chemical agents as protesters, some of whom lobbed rocks, bags of garbage, and water bottles at the police. Brooklyn Center's mayor ordered a curfew until 6 a.m., and the local school superintendent said the district would move to remote learning on Monday out of an abundance of caution. The woman who said she was the victim's mother identified him as Dante Wright, 20 years old. It, of course, injected more frustration and anxiety into the Twin Cities, where Mr. Floyd's death and the destructive protests that followed are fresh in the residents' mind. We're not exactly sure what happened. Here are the details as we know right now. Chief Tim Gannon of the Brooklyn Center Police Department said an officer had shot the man on Sunday afternoon after pulling his car over for a traffic violation and discovering that the driver had a warrant out for his arrest. As the police tried to detain the man, he stepped back into his car, at which point an officer shot him. The man's car then traveled for several blocks and struck another vehicle, after which the police and medical workers pronounced him dead. Chief Gannon did not give any information on the officer who fired or say how severe the crash had been, though the passengers in the other car were not injured. The chief said he believed that officers' body cameras had been turned on during the shooting. So, Alan, I hate to start off this way, but, you know, here we go again.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Here we go again. I am so unhappy about what we are seeing in this country. And I am so unhappy about what police think their role has to be We had the Army officer, Joe. I'm sure you've seen the clips
Virginia,
from that one.
Yeah. Yep.
In Virginia, who really was putting up with a terrible confrontation with a jerky officer. And look, we know that police are important, but they are not omnipotent, and they are and when they pull this kind of stuff, all they're doing is digging their own professional graves, because people are just not ready to have this anymore. So I guess that's where I am this morning.
Sienna, what do you make of the situation?
Well, like you said earlier, we don't know many details about what happened in Minnesota, even though we know it's tragic and it's hard to see again. Quite frankly, you know, it's as an African-American, it's really hard to watch. And so I tend to turn away, unfortunately, from a lot of these stories because it's a little overwhelming to deal with. The story I was dealing with was the story that was out of Virginia that Alan spoke of. I was just looking into that one a little bit more because, you know, at least there was no violence on the video. I've been watching what happened in that interaction. And I got to say, it's very disheartening after everything that went on with George Floyd, that we're still dealing with it at this level, that is still coming forth like so quickly. We're seeing these events happen. We thought that hopefully after what happened last year in March, that police organizations were going back in-house, right? And rethinking the way their officers interact with the community. That's what we all would like to think about what happened after last March, is that that's what was happening, is they're rethinking how they interact. And what we're seeing is that that's not happening. If anything, it seems like the tenor has gone up a little bit more, and that the, you know, that is a little more confrontational, as we saw in the Virginia video. And so that's concerning to myself. I know it's concerning to other people in the community about how are we really going to reach law enforcement, because there was this big backlash about defund the police. Huge. That's a terrible thing to say, you know. But now as we're just trying to figure out, well, we don't want to defund you. How do we get you to rethink how you approach policing? And I think that's the frustrating conversation that we need to have.
Absolutely.
And it's very frustrating as people of color of communities, like figuring out how do we get an actual change.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, and so how do we get actual change? And it's not happening in the Minnesota legislature. You know, they passed some bipartisan reforms last year, the legislature approved a bill restricting chokeholds, changing the training so that it's less militaristic, and requiring other officers to intervene when an officer is using excessive force. But what it didn't do, and what the bigger push is now nationally, I think, because we're seeing it as maybe the only thing that will work at this point where policing has been infiltrated by white supremacist groups and others, right? It's a systemic issue. There are lots of good people in the system trying to reform it from the inside, but there's still a healthy problem, an unhealthy problem of sickness that remains. And we're really talking about qualified immunity and the shields that officers have that don't only shield good actors, right, that don't need it, but that more importantly shield bad actors from facing personal consequences because they can hide behind the official title, the government, the government action that they purport to engage in when they're doing their job. The problem is when they don't do it correctly, when they violate the Constitution, the state and federal Constitution, when they're doing their job, they should be held accountable. And so there are pushes now to really get at qualified immunity and poke holes in qualified immunity to make sure that we're not shielding officially this type of you know, anti-constitutional behavior in the police force, because there are leaders in police reform and in police departments who are frustrated about the tools that or the lack of tools in order to hold their own ranks accountable because of the way that the system is structured, right? And so we've got a lot of work to do, obviously. I'm glad that we're hearing more about these things and that there's a more diverse coalition of people interested in tackling them than there has been in the past. But obviously, it's a huge, huge problem, and any reforms that have been made have not gone far enough.
You know, now, Sarah, I think there are people who are listening right now who are not as familiar as you and I may be with what qualified immunity means. You've mentioned it a couple of times. Could you just spend a couple of seconds on that?
Yeah, and I was trying to find the words that aren't qualified immunity. But basically, if an officer is acting in his or her official capacity, there are certain laws in place that shield that individual from being held personally responsible if they were acting in accordance with their governmental duty. Being part of what the push is to draw some finer lines around that. Like maybe you're acting in your official capacity, but you went outside the bounds of your own laws and procedures, right? For example, you engaged in a chokehold when those have been banned by the legislature, or you have used excessive force when it wasn't warranted. You should be not just, suspended and then have the department have to implement reforms, or you have to go to a sensitivity training. You can be personally held responsible for a crime or for a breach of civil liability, and you can be sued in your personally because you acted outside the bounds of your government job, or changing the law so that it doesn't, so it can be, even if you're acting as a government official, you're still doing something that's against the law, right? And so, like, we need to tease out the reason why these rules are in place is to make sure that that governments can do their job without being weighed down by multiple civil suits, or that government actors can do their jobs, right? But the problem is that it also serves as a shield for bad actors.
One of the things
that helps.
It does help.
Thank you.
I want to get to Libby here on this. I just want to add one of the things, again, I prefaced all of this by saying there's so much that we don't know about this case. And what we've heard from the mother of Duante Wright, who was the man who was shot and killed, that he was apparently stopped for having air fresheners in the car, that enough that there is a law apparently in Minnesota that you can't have too many that are obstructing your view, and that apparently was the reason that he was pulled over. The question then becomes why, and another point is that as he was being pulled over, he called his mother because he wanted that kind of running soundtrack for her as someone else, even though his girlfriend was in the car, to have that going while he was interacting with police. What we don't know is why he exited the car, why someone, even if it was something like an air freshener, why he would be asked to get out of the car. And the questions being asked this morning, the question that is being asked, one of many, is did the police know about the warrants at that time or later? And that's a key question. Libby Post.
You know, if the police would routinely pull over people who have big phones up on their dashboard for their nav programs, right, that they don't have the in-dash ones, but they put their big phones up there, and those are mostly white people who, you know, they don't get pulled over. They don't get pulled over, and their view is obstructed. It's like, what excuse can we use to pull somebody over who's driving while black? That's really what this sounds like. It's mind-boggling that this continues to happen, given, and especially in Minnesota, given what's happening. What'll be interesting, to bring it back to New York, is that, last April, the governor gave every municipality orders to reinvent their police departments. I know that there are some places like the city of Saratoga Springs where there was a 10-month work done by a large group of people, and then the city said, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to keep things basically the way they are. We'll make a few little tweaks, but we like things just the way they are. And, you know, that city is plagued with racial strife, you know, which is seething underneath the veneer of Saratoga Springs. And so, let's see what happens in New York State, if any of these plans are really going to be implemented and any police departments ever really get reinvented. And again, I'm not saying defund the police. I'm not saying get rid of law enforcement. I'm saying get rid of the white supremacists in law enforcement, have better training for law enforcement, have them understand racial disparities in law enforcement, and for them to get out of their little cocoons of, I have the power and you don't.
We have just less than a minute before we go to our break and go to a couple of the letters that we have. I don't understand, says Bill, I don't understand why policemen have to make every stop they make into a life or death situation. Yesterday's Minnesota event, the 20-year-old driver had apparently given the identification to the officers that stopped him. Obviously, the police knew where they could find him, or at a minimum knew who he was. So what if he got back into his car? Did that merit shooting him? And that is that question.
It's the first sentence that bothered me a little in the letter. I think it's quite clear that there are lots of cops who do their jobs and they do them well, mm-hmm. And they stop people respectfully, and it goes there. It's not that every cop is behaving that way,
right?
You know,
and that every situation is, as he points out, a life or death situation.
Yeah.
Let's pause. We'll have much more when we come back, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Shartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post making up the program this morning. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll go to news from the BBC, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post making up our panel. We're talking about the most latest shooting in Minnesota that happened yesterday afternoon with protests overnight. We have many letters on the subject. I will get to as many as I can here in the moments that we have. Let's see. Tony writes, I've said this before and I'll repeat it now. Why are we not investing in the creation of more non-lethal weapons so a policeman does not have to use a gun to subdue a potential assailant? Meanwhile, William writes, it's revealing that none of the panel mentioned the issue of compliance, even though in nearly every one of these police shooting tragedies, as with the recent one in Minnesota, it began with the suspect resisting arrest. I don't know that we know that, but okay. Also, New York City cut $1 billion
from it. That sure wasn't true with the Army lieutenant, right? I mean,
right.
You know, he couldn't have done more. He kept showing his hands. He kept speaking reasonably to them, and they were quite arrogant with him. So I don't think we should assume that it's all one
resisting
way.
Resisting arrest, right. Also, New York City cut.
Exactly. Sorry.
Sienna, go ahead.
Joe.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and what he did in that Virginia case is exactly what I would do, is he drove to a lighted gas station because he did not feel safe pulling over on a dark street. I believe it was like a mile and a half, or it was a significant distance to get there. But he did drive slowly. He did not drive off fast. Like it was a chase situation to a lighted gas station where he felt safe. And that's the right thing to do. That is what they're telling people of color to do. They're saying, go to a lighted place, put your hazards on, put your hands out the window so they see you're not reaching for anything. And the fact that individuals of color have to do these things during a stop should be infuriating. You have to understand that when you have an interaction with law enforcement, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're a person of color, for the most part, it's a heightened situation because of what the atmosphere is. You automatically think that something may happen to you. And so I feel like individuals always give grace to the police officers, as they should, because they're putting themselves in a dangerous situation. But what about the person being pulled over? They are also in a heightened situation. They're also very scared. And so I think that also has to be taken into account when you're talking about these situations. People are scared. I feel like that's important to note.
Absolutely. I do want to get to the second part of William's note, which says also New York City cut $1 billion from its undercover crime unit and now got rid of qualified immunity for its officers. The effect is police will pull back, resulting in more black-on-black murders and higher crime rates on a city where crime has already skyrocketed in the past year. Anyone on that, and if that is true?
Well, first of all, we don't know. I don't think it is true. I think I know where the letter writer is coming from because of the nature of his letter. I do think that qualified immunity lets people get away with it, lets cops get away with it, and that shouldn't be the case. It's that simple. And by the way, if you noticed in the Virginia case, am I wrong? Didn't they pepper spray him for no reason at all?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's what I thought.
Right. What's
New York City Council did pass qualified immunity reform 2 weeks ago at the end of March. I actually noticed it on there's a write up on the Cato Institute website, which is not necessarily known for being left leaning. So maybe this individual wants to take a look at their assessment. But the myth of black-on-black crime being and the rates at which crime occurs broken down by demographic, proportionate to the percentage of population, it's a loaded term. Using that term means that typically the person hasn't taken the time to read the studies about ethnic breakdown and crimes, and certainly haven't read the studies between that and policing. This listener is putting a lot of complicated, nuanced issues together in sort of a more simplified framework that actually misses the reality of the situation, both in policing and what's accurate in terms of policing, and being black and living in a society that doesn't regulate policing the way that it should.
You know, you've been talking about this Virginia case, and I think it's worth noting that that actual stop happened in December, and it's taken this long before we've seen the video has been released and we know more about what has happened, which just leads you to wonder, you know, how many of these are brewing and that we don't know about. But one of the police officers accused of using excessive force has been fired following an investigation. However, the other officer is still in service. And the reason that the Army officer was stopped was because he was missing plates on a brand new SUV.
But he had plates in the back window.
Correct.
It was brand new, but he did have plates. Yeah.
That is obviously another case, and now the town was at the end of their investigation, which is why we know about it. Now, let's go back to letters and go to Ricky, who says, it seems to me that there is a cycle with these tragic killings of black people. Police kill an unarmed black person. Unrest and violence breaks out as response. Right-wing big media puts the unrest and violence as lead story and focus their anger on Black Lives Matter. Also, this from Duncan, who says, simply cannot believe the news from Minneapolis today. Police shoot an unarmed individual because there's a warrant out for their arrest. Why shoot? Why use deadly force? While we don't know the details, unless this individual was posing a threat, there's absolutely no rationale. Police training is completely out of control and has become an indelible stain on police forces throughout this nation. We go to Erica, whose email has the subject line, "I'm pissed off." Have we learned yet that when you give a racist a stage, all other racists think it's time to come out and cleanse the wound? Also, regardless of the details, I'd bet my life his warrant was not for a crime punishable by death. Since when did America decide citizens can execute people for all crimes at will? And then protesters react and the narrative becomes their reckless behavior. And we go to John, who says, how do we balance the fact that guns are rampant in the public? Every criminal and mentally ill individual has an AR-15 on their wall and potentially in their car. The police are rightly worried about being a militarized situation and being in one because everyone has military-grade weapons.
Well, statistically, it's the white men that they should then be targeting and afraid of. Just throwing that out there.
Well said.
Everyone does not have
right.
such a gun.
No, not everyone has such a gun.
I don't have one.
No, but I think what Sarah is saying is the preponderance of these folks who have done the shooting with the AR-15s are angry white men.
Mm-hmm. I hear what she's saying. Yeah, sure.
That's the point. But I also think, you know, Erica's letter speaks to the incredible, well-honed art of playing the victim so that you create the situation and then you turn yourself into the victim to then bolster the reason for your actions.
So could you give us a specific on that one? For example, comma, pause.
Well, she talked about, you know, Joe, can you read her letter again? Because it was two letters ago. Erica.
Yeah, okay. Give me a second.
Joe deposits a lot of these.
Yeah, I moved.
In the circular file.
I moved on.
I know, in the virtual circular file.
And yes, here we go. So what do you want me to read? Have we learned yet that when you give a racist a stage, all other racists think it's time to come out and cleanse the world? Also, regardless of the details, I bet my life, as warrant, was not for a crime punishable by death. Since when did America decide citizens can execute people for all crimes at will? And then protesters react and the narrative becomes their reckless behavior.
That's
it. And you heard the cop who got fired. I believe that's the one who got fired, who's giving the guy in Virginia a hard time, say, you're going to ride the lightning. Did anybody else hear that one? You're going to ride the lightning?
And what were you saying, Libby?
Well, that's it. The last sentence there was the issue, is that, you know, they create this situation where people come out into the street and protest, and then those who create the situation consider themselves the victims of the protests. They're very good at portraying themselves as the victims of a situation that they themselves perpetrated. We keep seeing it over and over and over again.
The second officer, who I believe is still on the force in the Virginia case, what Alan was responding to, the Joe Gutierrez responded, "What's going on is you're fixing to ride the lightning, son." And that was what he said at the time. And again, I should mention that the reason that story has come out is now that the officer, the black army officer who was pulled over, is suing the police department. All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to our discussion. Back to the letter as we go to Susan, who writes this on qualified immunity. "I am with Alan. We must wait and see what result New York City sees. At least they suspended police's current vast entitlement. Also, I feel that our words as we respond to this gut-wrenching news are too polite, too calm, too measured. We're witnessing horror visited upon citizens." And I don't disagree with Susan on that last point. I just think it's probably we're being careful until we know a little bit more than we know. Military personnel serving in the field, says Kimberly, are trained to shoot first and ask questions later. We need to do a much more thorough screening of police candidates. And while we're at it, let's return to training them as and calling them peace officers. That from Kimberly. We go to this one from, Nan from Albany writes, after George Floyd's murder, I started purposely taking a moment whenever I get into my car to think about how, if I were black, I should behave if pulled over by the police. It may seem silly, but it gives me a tiny sense of what black people go through every single day.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear from Sienna on this one, because there's something called the conversation, which, you know, I have a African-American grandchild. And, you know, I know that those kids have got to be told what to do when this inevitably will happen to them. And it will be inevitable.
It's very true. Like, I've shared before, I have a 9-year-old son. And so sometimes he's getting kind of tall now. And to me, he's just a baby. But, you know, take your hood off. You know, I tell him all the time, we walk through the store, take your hood off. If he's going through, you know, through the aisle by himself and I'm in another aisle, you know, you want to make him look I don't want my son to look threatening at all. And that shouldn't be something that a young 9-year-old should have to think about. Right. And that's what we're fighting against and that's why it's so important, because you have these kids who have to shoulder responsibilities of an adult because of the police officers or whoever's law enforcement misconceptions or stereotypes about what they think is going to happen. You have these young kids having to shoulder that responsibility, and it's a lot for me, a 9-year-old, you know, but it's a conversation we have to have, and it's a heavy conversation. And, you know, they're not having these conversations in school. They're not having these conversations to everyone in his local Bethlehem school. They're not all saying that to all the kids. No, it's only my son that I have to have this conversation with him at home. How else to make a child feel, more pressure on him? Because he knows all his good friends, they don't have to deal with this.
Right.
That's right.
And the efforts that you have to take as a mother to keep your child safe and to make them aware of what is out there.
But in the end, it's exactly. As Sienna says, it's not fair.
No, absolutely not.
Why should one person, because of skin pigmentation, have to face this as opposed to somebody else? It's awful.
We welcome your letters on this panel at WAMC.org. I'm going to move on to other topics. We have just about 10 minutes before our top of the hour break, so we'll get to other stuff. Let's go to the story from the front page of the New York Times today of young migrants crowding shelters, posing a test for the president. That's the headline from the New York Times. The desperate plea landed this week in the email inboxes of employees and government agencies like the Department of Homeland Security and NASA. Will you consider taking a 4-month paid leave from your job to help care for migrant children in government-run shelters packed with new arrivals at the border? The request to much of the federal workforce came from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is at the heart of a frantic effort by the Biden administration to keep up with the surge in young people crossing the southwestern border, hoping to reunite with relatives already in the United States. The numbers are daunting. In March, border agents encountered nearly 19,000 children at the border, the largest number recorded in a single month, most of them fleeing poverty and violence in Central America. And the flow of migrant children is expected to only increase in the coming weeks. More than 20,000 children and teenagers are in the custody of a government system that is already at 103% of capacity, including nearly 17,000 in shelters run by the health department, according to briefing materials by Operation Artemis, a response to the border crisis led by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. So we have two immigration experts on our program this morning. So, Sarah, let me begin with you on this.
So I think I'd like to recharacterize the response in lieu of frantic, because, you know, I think that signals something more like what we heard under the Trump administration, and really a whole of government approach is the language that I would use. You know, we didn't see the Trump administration marshaling every resource that could be mustered from its administration to respond in a humanitarian way to an influx, the influxes that happened under the Trump administration. Instead, we saw targeted policies to rip children out of parents' arms, which is not happening. Unfortunately, what is happening is that fewer people actually have been let in this quarter at this point in time than Trump allowed into the country, actually, in this quarter in 2019. Because of the Title 42 law that was enforced in a particular way under the Trump administration that has been left in place, which basically says that recent arrivals are, you know, absent a compelling reason, even more compelling than what is traditionally required under a typical asylum claim, are automatically sent back under sort of an expedited removal process, we would call it, or like basically like you speak to an agent and the agent arranges for you to go home. Yeah. And what's happening is that because unaccompanied minors have separate laws that allow for them to be processed around the boundaries of Title 42, there are some families, not all, there are some families who are being sent back under Title 42 and are being told, you know, that's part of the deal at the border right now. And so in order to get their kids to safety, are sending their children with the hope that they may be able to come through a different way later. It's a sticky problem caused by, I've said it before, multiple layers of inaction and ineffective action and unlawful action by the Trump administration that is now culminating in the first quarter of a presidency where there hasn't been enough time to undo all the damage that was done in order to right the ship. But what is being done is that people are being held for briefer periods of time. Children in particular are not being left to languish in these temporary facilities. And again, it's a whole of government approach, right? Let's send all of our the resources that we have in place now. What it looks like in the future, I'm much more curious about and invested in making sure that we advocate for true reforms in terms of how the border is managed. And I'll stop there for now. And I mean, even the name, but real quick, even the name of the operation, Operation Artemis. Artemis is regarded as she's a Greek goddess, and she's the patron of girls and young women and a protectress during childbirth. Just that signal alone is a dramatic shift from the secret family separation policy enacted under the Trump administration.
Sienna.
I just want to double down on basically what Sarah's saying, but I also want to point out, you know, you have to recall that when families would come to the border during the Trump administration, the adults were being prosecuted, criminally prosecuted, and sent back, and then the children, you know, were separated. So that's not what we're seeing here. We're seeing families come to the border and they're being turned, fingerprinted and turned away, the complete family. And then what you're hearing is that a lot of these families, when they go back to Mexico, they're making these hard decisions, as Sarah already said, to send their children without them just to get to a safe place. And then the second thing that we want to make sure that we highlight, but that was the main thing. And the second thing I wanted to say was you have to also remember that the coyotes and the smugglers, they're making a lot of money right now perpetuating this. I'm hearing that they're saying to people down in Central America, with Biden, there's no deportations. So pay us, we'll take you to America. And you guys have to remember that's also a huge business. And so that is what individuals are hearing on the ground in Central America when they're paying these coyotes and these smugglers to bring them to the border. And so they're not hearing the message from the Department of Homeland Security Secretary saying, don't come, this is not the time to come. what they're hearing from people on the ground, the coyotes, the smugglers, is come, pay us, we'll take you, no deportation under Biden. Mm-hmm. So that also, that's also part of it.
You know, on top of that, we now know that the Mexican government and the Mexican president, who was very close to Trump, I understand, or too close to Trump, I understand, are now saying, wait a second, this isn't our responsibility. This is a shared responsibility between the United States and Mexico. So where's the assumption that you can kick them out and that they'll be okay here? And a fascinating part of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Libby?
First of all, I think the marketing of this, that it, when Sarah talked about Artemis and it brought back my the early days of my feminism when we would all change our names and I had a friend who changed their name to Artemis. You know, it sends a signal for those who understand. I mean, not, you know, I don't expect poor folks from Central America who's just trying to survive to really understand it, but it certainly does send a message to people in this country who are, who have some recognition of what Artemis, who Artemis was. From a messaging point of view and a marketing point of view, it really is a total change of where we're going and who we are. I'm just waiting for the Republicans to continue their onslaught, considering that they created this problem in the first place. And Trump created this absolute mess at the border. And the Democrats and Biden are trying to do what's right from a human rights point of view and from just a plain humanity point of view, you know, of reuniting families, making sure these kids have a place to sleep, put a roof over their head, you know, make sure that they're not abused. I mean, that's the other thing that's gone totally, you know, not talked about and not really dealt with was the amount of abuse of these kids that happened during the Trump administration. And so while it looks from the pictures and the stories and the numbers, it looks horrible, and it's not a situation I'd want anyone in, I think it's probably a bit better, if not a lot better, than under the Trump administration, because you actually have people at the top and people in there at these places who actually care about the children and don't see them as the other.
We're going to pause there. We have a lot more to discuss, and we welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. First, we take a break, plus news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 12th of April and 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Immigration attorney and partner with the Albany Law Firm of Whiteman Osterman and Hannah Sienna Freeman Tolbert. And political consultant Libby Post, all making up the panel this morning. So we move on to other stories here. And we will we do have letters on the other things, and we'll go back to that in a few minutes. But I do want to move on to some other stuff and really not leaving the issue of immigration too far behind. But I do want to talk about immigrants and vaccines for the coronavirus. This from The Washington Post. And it talks about the ID that is needed to get a dose of the vaccine and how those IDs are so hard to come by. Immigrants have been turned away from pharmacies and other places after being asked for driver's licenses, social security numbers, and health insurance cards. Specific documentation not mandated by states or the federal government, but often requested at vaccination sites across the country, including in several areas. This particular article is coming out of the city of Boston, where this has become a problem. Often the request comes in English, a language that many of the vaccine seekers do not fully understand. Alan, how do we get around these these crucial issues? All right. I don't hear Alan.
Well, I have, this is Sarah.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
So there's a line between actually all of our stories this morning, from policing to the border to vaccinations. So hear me out.
Okay.
Imagine it presenting yourself at a vaccination site, and they ask for ID. And you're an undocumented immigrant or a partially documented immigrant even, but someone who's ineligible to get a driver's license. And this is why it was so important for New York State to pass the green light law 2 years ago, by the way, so that anyone who needs an identification can access services that they are entitled to. It keeps us all healthy. It's a matter of public health, right? And we needed a pandemic to learn that lesson, apparently. But so you go. And in every interaction that you've ever had, I mean, the talk that your parents have with you is not only do you potentially have darker skin, which raises, you know, the alert levels of police and immigration enforcement officers alike, but the other talk, which is, and also a consequence short of death is deportation, right? If police immigration authorities find out that you're here without documentation and feel... If you can feel the anxiety that causes walking in to get a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic to make sure that you don't die or that you don't transmit the virus to your elderly relatives or what have you. And it's the same fear that crops up. Like, what if I don't have, what if my ID is rejected? What if the person, and there are typically police around vaccine sites, and some particularly those run by the state. And you're thinking, like, what if these police officers are the ones that are cooperating with immigration enforcement? What if going to get a vaccination and not having an ID refers me to police, which refers me to immigration, which puts me in a jail, which schedules me on a flight? That is a real thing, a real fear based on actual events that happen in this country. That got worse under Trump in terms of cooperation between police and immigration. And add to that, that immigration enforcement officers, we know more white nationalists and white supremacists have infiltrated that group as a result of a lack of, you know, the Trump administration staffed up the Department of Homeland Security. It has the largest one. I think it's the second largest budget in all of government. And they, in order to staff up quickly, they decided not to do fingerprinting and certain background checks for some of these Customs and Border Patrol agents and other Department of Homeland Security officials. So, like, it's worse. The problem is worse among immigration police. And I hate to even use the term immigration police because they don't even get the training that police officers get. So, like, there's a whole thread through all of this that is then blamed, tying in Libby's comment, on, oh, well, it's these communities fear vaccines for good reason, by the way. But that's not all of it. We need to have these broader conversations. Immigrant justice is racial justice, and it's all tied together.
Alan?
What's the good reason? No, Sarah did so much better than I could have ever done. But my question is, you just made reference for good reason. What was the good reason?
Well, Henrietta Lacks. You know,
I'm sorry,
the
say again?
Story of Henrietta Lacks, black women's bodies have consistently, and immigrant women's bodies most recently in Georgia, in an immigration detention facility where unwanted hysterectomies occurred. Hysterectomies.
Yeah.
You know, like, that happens this year, 2021,
right.
2020, late last year, and under the Trump administration. So last quarter of last year, you know, like, these are stories making national news. So if you're an immigrant woman or you're a black woman seeking medical care, the odds are not great in terms of your safety from being experimented on, given the stories that have come out.
And, of course, it doesn't stop there. As Libby will probably want to tell you, New York may well lose a good deal of its oomph because people don't want to answer the census at the door for exactly the same kinds of reasons being held responsible by the, you know, immigration people.
Libby?
Well, I mean, yes, New York will probably lose a congressional seat or two because of...
Well, we know we're losing one.
Yeah,
the question
right.
Is that,
we're definitely
is
losing one because of the lackluster response to the census, which was not, I mean, I have to say this around the census. You know, there was money set aside for census campaigns across the state, and then COVID hit. And that money didn't get released until really, really late. And so some municipalities were able to do good campaigns if they had their own money, some didn't. And so that impacted the ability to, you know, get the count out. But there's also this fear because of the citizenship question, which did not make it onto the census, but all the media around that, you know, caused immigrant communities, undocumented folks not to want to answer and fill out the census because they thought, you know, ICE was going to be knocking on their door regardless of whether or not the question was on the census. And so it's all related. I mean, there's no two ways about this, and it all stems from the systemic racism and xenophobia that is really the backbone of this country and the backbone of our history. And in order for us to make any real changes, we have to really take a hard look at how this country was founded. You know, Black people were 3/5, and how, I mean, and it's not something that you can snap our fingers and it's going to go away overnight. There's just so much and so many layers. But when you talk about policing, you can make changes in the police departments. You can make changes in policing to cut down on that kind of abusive behavior. When it comes to healthcare, you can do certain things. You can do the education that needs to be done. Talk to people where they're at in the language that they understand by third-party validators that they trust so that they will get the healthcare that they need. We're seeing vaccine rates ticking up in Black and brown communities because it's not just white people telling them to do it, but it's their peers and people that they look up to, you know, celebrities and all that sort of stuff telling them that this is the right thing to do. So there is ways in the short term to deal with these issues that keep bubbling up and the systemic racism that it comes from and xenophobia. But then we also have to take a very hard look and a long-term look on how to correct this. And the part of the problem here is that, you know, we're facing a midterm election in what, 18 months, you know, yeah. That could change the face of Congress and we'll be right back to Trump's America.
Sienna.
I completely agree with what Libby and Sarah and Alan have said, but just to hone in more on the vaccine and communities of color, we're seeing it more, as Libby has said, that they're reaching out and the outreach has to be there. People, they need to see people like themselves getting the shot. And right. We need to have more celebrities doing. I mean, the same way that we had the push for the vote, we need to see that same push for the vaccine, right? To get people out of their houses and get into the polls. That's the push we need to see for the vaccine because they just don't trust it. They just don't trust it. And so I think it's hard to just, sometimes it's hard because I think people say a lot, you know, my communities of color are not getting the vaccine. But also we have to realize there's a huge conservative base that's not getting the vaccine as well.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
And so, you know, so let's not just say, you know, oh, they're, you know, communities of color, they're not listening. They don't know. Well, there's a huge conservative base that's getting disinformation as well. So there needs to be a bigger push, period.
All right, let's go to another story here. And again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. In fact, we can go to a couple of these. Jay writes, when a person enters this country illegally, they're entitled to nothing. They're not entitled to a driver's license and they're not entitled to any ID because they are illegal. That is the whole point. These are things that are set aside for our illegal immigration people. When you come here legally, you deserve nothing and should receive nothing. Oh, Sarah.
Oh, my God.
No person. No person oh my God. Is illegal. Yeah.
No person is illegal. Not one. Not you, not me, not anyone who comes here for any reason whatsoever. And actually, under the Constitution of the United States of America, there are constitutional rights that attach the moment your pinky toe hits the American soil. It's not enough, in my estimation, but it is something, and it's rooted in a fundamental value of this country. And honestly, well, okay, I'm a little fired up.
No, that's okay.
It's how the generations that birthed the person who is writing that letter arrived in this country. So this is a fundamental norm that Trump tried to erase, that Stephen Miller tried to erase, because they don't want more black and brown people becoming a part of the fabric of this country. And they were wrong, and their own courts told them so. And we continue to defend certain fundamental rights. Now, that being said, it is a privilege to drive a car and have a license. It is not necessarily a privilege that is granted with the issuance of an ID. An ID is just that, an identification card. You can get one at the Y when you sign up to work out. It's not, you know, giving a state identification is a public good that protects you and me and everyone else. And by the way, it reduces your insurance rates because there are fewer uninsured drivers on the roads. It is in your economic best interest, dear listener, to allow immigrants, undocumented persons, anyone who needs identification to be able to receive it from your state government.
Alan, what are you going to say?
Well, I'm a political scientist, and I watch why people do things. So anything I say doesn't necessarily mean I agree with it. And in fact, what I'm about to say, I don't agree with. And I hear and agree with everything that Sarah just said. Nevertheless, the reason that Donald Trump took on immigration is because he thinks there are enough people like the letter writer. I think you would agree, Sarah, like the letter writer, who will reward him politically for having done that. And I think that's something we should keep our eye on.
Sarah?
Definitely. And not reward it when it presents itself in our everyday life.
No, it's, you know, I agree with you. It's not right. I'm just saying there
are
political...
Well, you're agreeing with him, right?
Yeah. I'm just saying that's the charge. Yeah. That's the charge to every New Yorker. We need to have more of these conversations. I mean, I'm glad the person wrote in, but I'm also glad to correct the false things contained in the letter.
Santa, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's very well covered, because you don't want – I'm not going to go down that road, like Sarah said. talking about who entered the country first and how people enter the country. I mean, it's a slippery slope. That's why I say the letter writer, slippery slope.
And Libby?
There's not much more to say, but I too want to know whether or not this guy's grandparents or woman's grandparents came over on a boat, or when their ancestors did come over, they were not considered quote-unquote legal, I would assume. What kind of services they got? I mean, come on. You know, unless you're a Native American or an indigenous person in the United States, you came here on a boat or some other means of transportation.
We welcome your letters, panel.
Brought here against your will.
Right.
That. Right.
Absolutely.
Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to join in. We go to this story from the Washington Post. More than 100 corporate executives hold a call to discuss halting donations and investments to fight controversial voting bills. The corporate leaders gathered online Saturday to discuss new action to combat the controversial state voting bills being considered across the country, including the one recently signed into law in Georgia. Executives from major airlines, retailers, and manufacturers, plus at least one NFL owner, talked about potential ways to show they oppose the legislation, including by halting donations to politicians who support the bills and even delaying investments in states that pass the restrictive measures, according to four people who were on the call, including one of the organizers, Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, a Yale management professor. While no final steps were agreed upon, the meeting represents an aggressive dialing up of corporate America's stand against controversial voting measures nationwide, a sign that their opposition to the laws didn't end with the fight against the Georgia legislation passed in March. Alan.
It's a huge story. And the reason it's such an important story is that these guys would have not been on this side necessarily 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. They're there because they see the handwriting on the wall. And the reason that the Georgia legislature is doing what it's doing is because they see the same handwriting and they know they're done. And if they don't do extraordinarily, in my mind, negative things in order to preserve their status, they're gone. You won't see them back again. And that is what this is all about.
Libby?
What I find so disingenuous about all of this and about what Mitch McConnell said, that, oh, they can keep giving us money, but they should stay out of politics. Let's not forget who wanted the Citizen Union decision. It was the GOP who wanted corporations to be seen as people so that they could speak out on these issues and give money. And now when
Citizens United
is saying you're wrong, McConnell and the GOP want them to shut up. And the fact of the matter is that the, you know, Trump is calling for a boycott. He's got maybe 20 to 30% of the population following him. How many people will actually act on that boycott remains to be seen, because it's not an easy thing to do on a national basis. And you've got brands that everybody uses and enjoys speaking up against this. A boycott is not going to have the impact that they'd like it to have. And the businesses understand that their market is younger people for the most part. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, retirement products. We're talking about Coca-Cola. We're talking about baseball. We're talking about other products. And these businesses understand that they need the younger generation to have brand loyalty to them in order for them to prosper and continue. And Georgia is an old man's brand loyalty. It is not a young person's brand loyalty. It's an old man, old white man's brand loyalty compared to the markets that we have now, which are diverse, some of which have money to spend, and are younger. And so the companies understand this. Corporations understand this. What's important to them is their bottom line. And impairing voting rights and being on that side of that argument is bad for their bottom line.
It's also bad if you're the former president of the United States and you call for a ban of Coca-Cola and then moments later you are photographed with a can of Coca-Cola. Just saying.
Well, you know, maybe. Consistency is fodder for small minds when it comes to that stuff.
Sarah.
Yeah, I think Libby said it best. I mean, but this is the perfect exposure of the hypocrisy of a certain brand of politics and a certain brand of capitalism combined. And we see it everywhere. It's just rearing its ugly head. I'll be really interested to see what, if anything, this does in terms of shifting. I really, you know, Citizens United changed the landscape when it comes to political donations in a really terrible way. And now we're weaponizing corporate donations, it seems like, in a game of politics that bears little resemblance to the brand of to the type of politics that we need in a healthy democracy. So, you know, there's starting fights, and it's not an election, you know, a big presidential election year. So it'll be interesting to see in the meanwhile sort of how this plays out. I know not every average citizen is looking at donation reports, but I think we should.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And our last call here for the program for the panel section this morning, we have Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post. Right before the break, we were talking about corporations getting together to discuss how they deal with various localities having to do with voting rights and the laws that they pass. Sienna, we did not get to you, so I'll open hand you the floor for a moment, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
I mean, for me, I found it very encouraging because I think that speaks to what the majority of the country is saying. It just reflects that the corporations are seeing that. They know that if they don't support it, it's going to impact their bottom line. And so to me, that's just energizing. It should be especially energizing for the Democratic base, but it's just be energizing to see these corporations, you know, drawing a line in the sand, so to speak, and standing up for democracy. So that, to me, is exciting to see. So that's all.
Thank you.
You don't think they're standing up for democracy so much as standing up for profit, do you, Sienna?
Of course, it's about profit. You know, I'm one of those people that, you know, even though I understand that the bottom line is, you know, what the ultimate goal is, if we can reap some of those benefits, I like to see it. For example, you saw companies coming out in force of the Black Lives Matter movement. We know they're just doing that to engender communities of color to their corporations, but that's okay. I like to see it, and it's encouraging. So I think I figure with the saying is don't throw something away with the bathwater.
Yeah, the baby.
I think that's appropriate.
Yeah. All right, let's go to New York City politics. This is a fun story. So 10 weeks to the finish line, and the race for mayor in New York is heating up with the primary weeks away. Candidates are sharpening their attacks, ramping up in-person events, and preparing to spend the millions of dollars that they have squirreled away for such a run. So who is the leader of the pack? Well, Andrew Yang, the 2020 presidential candidate who has shifted his personality-driven campaign to the New York City mayoral race and was over the weekend at the reopening of Coney Island. After months of conducting virtual fundraisers and participating in an endless round of online mayoral forums, candidates are sharpening their attacks and going out to the streets and preparing all that that money to spend all that money that they have. 10 weeks before the June 22nd Democratic primary that is likely to determine the next mayor, four candidates currently make up the top tier of contenders, according to available polling and interviews with elected officials as well as party strategists. There is Mr. Yang, the undisputed poll leader, Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough President, Mr. Stringer, and Maya Wiley, a former counsel to Mayor Bill de Blasio and a former MSNBC analyst. But the race appears fluid enough for a candidate to break out late, like Mr. de Blasio did in 2013, with many undecided voters only now beginning to consider the race, according to interviews with New York Democrats across the city and polling data. Alan.
Well, I think Yang right now is, you know, he's the leader and he will stay the leader. And you can tell by the fact that they're all ganging up on him, as they did with Biden and, you know, in other cases. So, as a native-born New Yorker, somebody, it never really leaves you. Grew up on 96th Street, was part of a political club. I think there's an image of the New York voter as being way out to the left. It's not true. The New York voter, I believe, is somebody who is more moderate than you would expect, or that some people would expect. So if you're asking me what I think Yang could well be the candidate.
Libby Post.
I think that Yang is
I just like how you started that.
I think Andrew Yang is going to end up as a flash in the pan, because ultimately I think de Blasio became the accidental mayor after Chris Quinn's campaign, you know, imploded 8 years ago. But I think that New York voters want a little more substance. I'm hoping that somebody like Scott Stringer or Maya Wiley rises up. And the other part of this is that there's ranked voting now.
Right.
So whoever comes out of this primary, there'll be yet another vote. But, you know, Yang just doesn't stand for much. And New Yorkers believe in things. So I'm just glad I'm not involved in any of it. That's all. Somebody called me early on, and I said, no thanks.
Why don't you just put $5 on the table? I'll match it. And in New York State now, we're going to have sports gambling, right? So,
right. Mobile sports gambling.
And I hope we can also have mobile political gambling, you know.
Yeah.
I think we already do that. It's called absentee ballots.
No, I'm talking about, you're wrong. You know, Yang's going to win. I'll put $5 on the table.
So
you really think he's going to win, Alan?
I do.
Wow.
So what about Scott Stringer? Here's a guy who's been around for a long time, has been playing the game.
I've always thought of him as a young man.
He's a good, solid, progressive. He has stood by the LGBT community when it wasn't fashionable, and he knows how to run things. He knows how city government runs. He's the kind of person that, you know, you need at the helm, especially after the last 8 years of sort of chaotic government.
He's a good guy.
He is a good guy. I really like him.
Sarah or Sienna, do you wish to enter the mobile political betting?
No. I'm disappointed. You know, I was that a lot of the reformers and the more progressive candidates are thinning out. But in New York City is a crazy, wild. You know, I think I actually agree with Alan that it's a much more moderate place than people realize. And I'll be keeping an eye on it just because it matters with regard to upstate downstate politics.
Right.
I mean, and it matters to millions of New York City residents, of course. But I just as somebody who isn't a voter and doesn't live in the city, I feel like very much a spectator, which I hate to be in politics because it matters. It matters for people all over the state who the particular blend of this person. But we also still have up in the air our the governor's office. And so it'll be interesting to see, again, the interplay between whoever the new New York City mayor is and whoever the governor is.
Can you imagine the governor dealing with Andrew Yang?
He doesn't want to. No, you know, he has a general rule. Come on now, Libby, you know it as well as I do. His general rule is, if you're not me, you're no good. So
I understand that, but you know, it would be fun to watch.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing, though, in 1 year? I mean, a year. So in 12 months' time, Andrew Yang was on the stage of a debate for president of the United States, and now, a year later, is on the stage for mayor of New York. It shows a lot about that role of that office.
But also, Joe, what's interesting here is that we are going through terrible, terrible times when it comes to Asian Americans, right? And here we have somebody with the name Yang who is running, and New Yorkers, who are wonderful people, are saying, enough of that. We're, at least according to the polls, we're behind him.
Sienna, anything you'd like to add to this?
Oh, no, I'm fine.
Okay. I didn't know how people were going to go on the New York City politics thing. I get it. I just want to real quick some of the shots that Yang has taken over the last couple of weeks. Mr. Stringer is sought to brand Mr. Yang as a politically inexperienced promoter of ill-conceived ideas like a casino on Governor's Island.
$1,000 for everybody.
Adams has ripped into Mr. Yang for leaving the city during the pandemic. Ms. Wiley has criticized how Mr. Yang has discussed ideas like stimulus spending, while a Wiley campaign ad compared him to a mini Trump, a serious accusation in Democratic politics. So there is.
Well, now, wait a minute. I want to understand the $1,000 for everyone, Alan. You're talking about a universal basic income, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific idea. I don't think that falls into the category of a harebrained idea. I actually know it does. It is a terrific idea. It's an idea that's actually got a lot of traction in national, federal conversations at the moment because we know for a fact that it reduces poverty dramatically. It is Andrew Yang's best idea is a universal basic income.
I'm with you.
All right. A final story for this morning, and we go to our old friends, Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell. So Donald Trump was out speaking this weekend. He didn't go far. He spoke at Mar-a-Lago. But he called a Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell. This is a quote, so I won't get in trouble, from the former president. Called Mitch McConnell a dumb son of a bitch, as he used a Saturday night speech to Republicans to blame the senator for not helping overturn the 2020 election and reiterated false assertions that he won the November contest. Trump, speaking at a Republican national gathering at his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, excoriated a number of Republicans, even as he publicly called for party unity, focusing on those who voted to convict him in impeachment proceedings. But he saved his sharpest vitriol for the Kentucky Republican. If it were Schumer instead of McConnell, they would never allow it to happen. They would have fought it, he said of the election certification on January 6th, the day his supporters led an insurrection on the Capitol to block President Biden's formal victory. There's one line here that I thought was great. I hired his wife. Did he ever say thank you? Trump said. He then mocked Chow for resigning in response to the January 6th events and behavior that day. She suffered so greatly, he said, his voice dripping with sarcasm. He later called McConnell a stone-cold loser. Witnesses say that some attendees left the private event early with the speech getting only mixed reviews.
I can't imagine.
I would like to say something. He's such a jerk.
Yes. Anything else? Yeah. No, that's good. So if you're, go ahead, Sarah.
I know it was me.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sienna, and then Libby.
Oh, it was Libby, but I was going to say,
really confused.
You know, what's but I will say something about it. When I was looking into the story, and one of the things that was amazing to me is they were saying that Donald Trump has about $85 million of cash on hand, whereas the Republican National Party only has 84. I mean, it just shows you how much power he still has in the party. I mean, I was really shocked in light of, you know, all of his upcoming indictments, I hope. That he still wields so much power, but he does. He does. And that is amazing to me. So I was not surprised by him making these statements and attacking Mitch McConnell.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being part and being with us this morning. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. You're a great leader.
Thank you. Right back to you. Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post, I thank you all for being with us. Have a good week. We will be back right after this.